The following episode of the DJ Bob Show was recorded before the SAG after strike began. We and our guests fully support the strike and the efforts SAG after actors fighting for fair wages and protections.
Hey, I'm Bob Runkle, and for as long as I can remember, I've loved pop culture. Despite the challenges I've faced in my life, pop culture has always been there for me. I love talking to people and being a platform for others to share their thoughts, stories. Because if there's one thing I never get tired of, it's seeing driven, talented, and inspiring individuals follow their dreams, no matter what obstacles are in their way. And I know a thing or two about that. Welcome to the DJ Bob Show. I'm DJ Bob. Roll it. From Maroon 5 to marriage and family therapy, our next guest has done it all. Ryan Duzik is here, and he was the founding drummer of the band Maroon 5. Later, he transitioned to being a marriage and family therapist after dealing with some difficult stuff in his own life. And we covered the band's rise to fame, his recent book chronicling all of this, and so much more. This is a short but sweet chat, and I hope you get a lot out of it. For those that don't know you, could you kind of give us a little bit of an elevator pitch of who you are, what you've done, and kind of summarize your journey?
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me to do this. I'm Ryan Duzik. I was the founding drummer of the band Maroon 5. Started that band in 1994 in my parents' garage when I was 16 years old. With Adam Levine and Jesse Carmichael and Mickey Madden. We took that band all the way from the garage to the biggest stages in the world over the course of about a decade. It was really a labor of love. It was our passion. It was our everything. We were really connected as a creative force and had big dreams and were able to finally accomplish them. And then in the course of promoting our first big hit album, Songs About Jane, I kind of slowly broke down over the course of a few years on the road. At the time, it was a physical injury that manifested in terms of my inability to play the drums the way I used to. But in retrospect, I can see that there was a mental health aspect to it as well that kind of came to a head in the midst of all of that touring and all of the demands, the external demands meeting up with the internal demands of my own sort of psyche and ways in which I dealt with anxiety and things like that. So I leaving that that career, not just that career, but that identity was really devastating for me. And I dealt with depression, grief, anxiety, and alcoholism for about a decade after I left the band in 2006. And finally, I entered recovery in 2016, and that's when this whole new part of my life started, where I found new purpose, new direction, new meaning, just by being connected to things that were fulfilling and purposeful. I became a therapist. I went back to school and got a master's in clinical psychology to become a therapist. I wrote a book called Harder to Breathe, which is a memoir about my whole story, my journey, and the things that I learned both in the hard times and in the great times. And I'm on this new mission now where I'm, you know, trying to be of service. That's the thing that's given me a lot of purpose and new identity is being of service, both as a therapist and as a mental health advocate. And just really, you know, telling my story in any context that seems like it could offer some hope in recovery from whatever you may struggle with, whether it's addiction, or anxiety or any other form of mental health, challenge. So whether it's my book, Harder to Breathe, or speaking to people in groups or, you know, doing interviews or just working one-on-one with people, it really gives me a lot of fulfillment and purpose at this point in my life to be of service in that way.
Well, Now, if 2003, 2004, you heard what you were doing right now, what do you think he would say?
Yeah, I would be shocked. I think if you told me 20 years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing, because at that point in my life, you know, there it was a singular drive to be the biggest band in the world. And, you know, to continue to have not just hit records, but to be important. I think we had a vision in our mind that after Songs About Jane, the next record would be our magnum opus. And I was looking forward to that. And I was looking forward to being five albums deep into our career and still creating something magical together. You know, I didn't really have any other vision for my life than what Maroon 5 was going to be in my mind. And so there's no way I could have foreseen what I'm doing now. It's weird because I had passions that in my life as a kid, that have led to some of the things that I'm doing now. And I had sort of forgotten about them when I was in the midst of everything with Maroon 5, because it became all consuming. There was just no room in our lives for anything but that. And in some ways I had kind of, I think, subjugated myself in my own mind, just because I was one fifth of this entity, this wonderful entity, but it was not my singular creative force. It was the collaboration of the five of us. So other things that I love, the other passions, writing, I always loved writing, being creative in an individual context. And you know, being a sensitive person, being an empathic person, being connected to other human beings in other ways than just performance wise musically. You know, I'd kind of put all that stuff on the back burner. And so it makes sense to me now to see the whole arc of my life and see that I ended up where I'm at now, but I definitely couldn't have seen that when I was in the middle of that, that whole storm that was the band at that point in my life.
Because you guys were everywhere. I mean, after Songs About Jane was released, it took a little bit to pop off. And then I would say in like the spring of 2004, it really hit with This Love. That was everywhere.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you when you first heard any of your records on the radio?
It was crazy. You know, we actually had a record deal before the one as Maroon 5, and that became Songs About Jane. We were a band before we were called Maroon 5. We were called Cara's Flowers. Cara was a girl we went to high school with, and the name of the band came from a night where we were being idiots out in the world and ended up delivering flowers to her house.
Max, my sister's name.
So oh, really? Yeah. Okay.
So whenever I see them, I'm like, oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. We have so many different connections, because I feel like, is it true that was founded, that band was founded at Five Towns College or something like that?
No, not exactly. We started the band in high school at Brentwood School in L.A. After that album failed, and I was, you know, the first time we heard our song on the radio was in 1997 on that record. We only heard it once or twice because that album tanked. So it was exciting for a minute, and then it all kind of went away, and we had to return home with our tails between our legs and kind of start over. And so at that time, in around 98, the band almost broke up. We kind of took a little bit of a hiatus, not knowing what direction we were going or if we were going to stay together. And Adam and Jesse spent a semester at Five Towns College in New York.
Yeah, that's right near me.
Oh, yeah? Long Island?
Yeah. I'm in awesome. Long Island right now. Yeah. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Small world.
Yeah. I mean, so when This Love pops off, even harder to breathe before that,
yeah,
it was everywhere. So do you remember hearing it on like Kiss FM or any of those major market stations? Like, what are your memories of like hearing your song on the radio where other people could hear it? Like, you know, like where, you know, people know it.
Yeah. Well, in 2002, I think the summer of 2002, we had already been on the road for probably 6 months at that point. That's when the album officially came out and the single Harder to Breathe came out. And I remember, you know, we were driving around for the first year and a half. We were driving around the States in a passenger van, just the five of us and a tour manager. And I remember one night, I think we were in Portland, Oregon. We were pulling into town late. And I don't even know if we had a hotel room or we were just going to be sleeping in the van or what. But they had told us that the video for Harder to Breathe was going to be airing on some late night show on MTV or VH1. And we were scrambling to figure out how to find a place that we could watch MTV or VH1 to see our video on TV for the first time. And so we found some swanky hotel, I think, in downtown Portland. And we were like begging them to let us just like turn it on in the bar downstairs. And we did. We saw our video for the first time with a bunch of strangers in a bar, you know, somewhere in downtown Portland. And I had forgotten about that until just this moment. That was the moment we saw our video on TV for the first time. It was very exciting, but it was very low key context. There wasn't a big party going on or anything. You have to remember that, you know, we were in the middle of touring for 3-4 years straight. There wasn't like sitting at home and watching it from afar. We were at the eye of the storm. So it was kind of hard to have context for when This Love blew up. You know, we were traveling overseas. We were in London. We were in Tokyo. We were all over the place. And you would walk into, you know, a mall on your day off or go into a movie theater and hear This Love playing. And that was bizarre, you know, because we were just playing it last night on stage somewhere and now it's on in a mall. So that was all just surreal, really. For me, though, that was when I started having problems performing around that time. And I ended up going home for a stretch while the band was still out on tour. And I was in my one-bedroom apartment back home watching the band from afar continue to do everything we'd been working towards. And then that's when it kind of hit me, because I was just a bystander at that point. And the band was just omnipresent at that point. You know, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing the music or seeing the video or seeing an advertisement for the album or the tour or whatever. And so, you know, I was feeling really sorry for myself, and it was hard to escape that because it was everywhere. And I remember actually Kiss FM here in LA. I don't know if you were talking about Kiss FM in New York or the one here.
In LA. Yeah.
In LA. That's, you know, that's the pop station I grew up listening to, Rick Dees in the Morning.
I love Rick Dees.
Yeah. I actually did an interview with Rick Dees, which was another surreal moment. I was sitting in my apartment and I was on the phone with Rick Dees on the radio, and the rest of the guys were off somewhere on the other side of the world. And that voice that I remember from my childhood, you know, the weekly top 40, that was a strange moment.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how, like, when we hear a song, it basically gives us an ear watermark of where we were and what we were doing. But yeah, when you hear these things, when you hear This Love, when you hear that whole first record, you can't... Can you listen to it as a listener, or does it just conjure up kind of not bad memories, but just memories that have deeper meaning than most people?
Yeah, it's definitely it's a combination of both. When you make a record like that, we knew at the time that we were making it that it was our last real chance, even though we were only about 25. We had already had a failed record deal before that, so this was our second record deal, and it was our last real chance to have a hit. And we were on a shoestring budget, and we were just kind of like all hands on deck. We really felt like the five of us and our producer, Matt Wallace, were all just kind of in a submarine together, working on this thing 24/7 and putting our heart and soul into it. But we were so inside of it, you know, because we were meticulous about every detail. And so when you're that close to it, it's hard to really hear it the way that an outsider would objectively anymore. All you're hearing is the imperfections and the things that you imagined sounding different, or, you know. So, you know, for the longest time, that's all we could hear. And even when it was blowing up and everyone was raving about the album, we were like, eh, it's all right. I guess the next one will be better. That was kind of our attitude. It was like, it was a good start. It took about a decade, I think, for all of us. It wasn't until maybe a decade had passed that I had some conversations with Adam and other guys about how special it really was, and being able to really recognize that that was a moment in time and a creation that was more than just the sum of the parts. You know, it was something magical kind of happened there. We were so inside of it that we couldn't see that until we'd had enough distance from it. Now I really can appreciate it, not just for what people love about it and the fans, but for just how special a moment in our lives that was, and how grateful I am for having been a part of it and having had that experience. It was a once in a lifetime experience that, you know, I think even for the other guys in the band who are still in the band, can recognize that, you know, you can't recreate that. That was just something. We had been together for 8 to 10 years when we made that record and toured on it, and they've been together for another 20 since. But that was just like that culmination of everything we've been working towards. And so I have nothing but gratitude for that record, and really I appreciate it for everything that is, warts and all. I still hear the imperfections, you know, but I think the imperfections are what kind of part of what makes it great, because it's right at that intersection of being a pop record with all of the gloss of melody and harmony and everything that's ear candy, but also just enough sort of grit and organic feel to it that it feels like human beings playing.
I love it. And that album is very special to me because it's such a touchstone in pop culture. I honestly think it's one of those iconic albums from that time period, because downloads were just starting to become a thing, like iTunes. And it was like one of the last albums where it's like you had to rely on the CD first before digital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before the whole digital media transition, because I don't think iTunes didn't start selling music until October of 2003. So you had a good year before digital took over.
Yeah.
And that's what I find really interesting. But another sector of your journey is mental health and therapy and, you know, for lack of a better term, getting through stuff.
Right.
And so what do you take from your music days and put it into your therapy sessions or your book or whatever you're doing in that space?
Well, I think that going back to school to become a therapist in my 40s, which I'm 45 now. I went back to school when I was, I guess, about 40. I think that my life experience, everything that I lived through, both good and bad, informed my approach to learning and my approach to being a therapist. I think that I bring myself into the room in whatever I'm doing as much as I do the education that I've gained, because I can relate to my clients and I can relate to the people that might read my book and hear me speak, because I've been through a lot of the same things. You know, the challenges that I had in my life are not terribly unique. The circumstances might be unique. You know, not everyone has been in a pop band that got to the level that we did, and some of the things we got to do as a result of that. But, you know, perfectionism, obsessive compulsiveness, anxiety, depression, putting a lot of pressure on yourself and not dealing well, maybe with disappointment and failure, struggling to find resilience, and then loss and grief and self-medication, alcoholism or addiction or otherwise. Those are all things that, you know, everyone can relate to on some level, if not personally, you know, someone in their family. We've all struggled at different points in our life, some more than others, of course. So, you know, the themes that come up in my story, in my journey are usually relevant. They come up in the conversations I have all the time. And so You know, I think that I can borrow from, like I said, both the good and the band types. When I look at the band and everything we did together, it was so inspiring, you know, to be a part of a collective, the teamwork, the camaraderie, the creativity in a collaboration. There's a synergy that happens when you have personalities in a room that are different but complementary. And I think that we can all kind of learn from the process of that and why it was special within that band. But I was individually struggling with things, you know, that were not major issues at that point, but became major issues when I was struggling on the road when the demands and the pressures of performance on that level intersected with the pressures I put on myself. So I'm very, you know, I can relate to people that have struggled with that a lot in their lives in any industry, whether they're in school or in the workplace, and just dealing with trying to find balance in their lives, trying to find ways to take care of themselves in the midst of high pressure situations, or just trying to get by, just trying to do their job and take care of their family, and whatever the specific context is for the individual. Again, they're themes that I think are universal. So I borrow from my own story a lot when I'm talking to people, and I probably do self-disclose and bring my own background into the room more than a lot of therapists would.
So I'm just curious. Do you have any questions for me about my life and what I do and my journey? Because I feel like we can share some stories and have some similarities there.
Yeah, well, I find it interesting and inspiring that you know, having been diagnosed at such an early age with cerebral palsy, you know, to be, you know, doing what you're doing now, and I just sense such a positive energy from you, and that hasn't limited you in what you are doing in your life. I wonder if that has always been the case, if you've always had that sort of very positive light about you. Or if that was something that you struggled with and had to work to get to the place you're at now.
I mean, it's really difficult because honestly, so many people in my predicament could be like, poor me, or feel bad for me. You know, I go through this stuff, and yes, I have my bad days, mm-hmm. but it's like, I created all of this because I couldn't play outside as a kid, but I could watch TRL, or I could listen to the radio, or I could buy the latest CD that was out. So I took everything that I could do and turned it into this.
Hmm. Wow. So do you feel a sense of connection in what you're doing now?
Absolutely. I always say I would rather be disabled than ambulatory.
Mm.
Because I wouldn't have all this time to foster this love of all this stuff.
Yeah, I find, you know, I write about in my book that the most important elements to a fulfilling life are connection and purpose. That's what I was lacking in my life for about a decade after I left the band. Because I had this great feeling of connection within the band to my brothers, you know, my team, and then to the music that we were making, the thing that we were creating. And of course, that provided a sense of purpose. And when I lost that, I felt this void. I couldn't really describe it then the way I can now in retrospect, but really everything that had been self-defining was gone. And it was in feeling sorry for myself, you know, in beating myself up, there was a lot of self-loathing and then punishing myself in a way that I thought I was coping, you know, by drinking too much and all that, really kind of punishing myself for the ways in which I felt negatively about myself. And it wasn't until I quit all that and I sort of stopped feeling sorry for myself and really got out into the world to try to find connection to life, connection to things outside of myself and the sort of isolated existence I was living at that time. and find new purpose. You know, I'm a big believer that having purpose in life, feeling that you're doing something that is meaningful to you, goes a really long way in terms of that existential void that we often feel for one reason or another. And so finding that in doing some of the things that I've been doing in the last 7 years, has been, you know, the biggest element in me getting out of that dark place and finding, you know, I won't say happiness, because happiness is just a
feeling, feeling content.
Content. Yes. Do you feel content at this point in your life?
Well, honestly, living with a disability, you're never fully content.
Sure.
But you find ways around it. I mean, I'll be honest, like, I had a moment like that where, for some reason, my podcast got taken down from a off every platform from a copyright strike. And I lost every single episode of our show. I didn't have any of the masters or nothing. So all that work that I did for like 10 plus years was gone. So I felt like, well, I can't book any interviews anymore, because how could people hear it? How can people obtain this information? But, you know, I fought for it. And I got what I wanted back. And so, like, we all have things that make us who we are. And that shape us. And I feel like this conversation is one of those things, because you and I are just sharing. We all struggle, but we're all finding ways to get through it. And one of the things I want to point out, and I mention this every episode, but it's important to bring up to you because I want to know your opinion on it. I never used to talk about my disability on this podcast. I hid it a lot because I wanted to be this polished top 40 radio DJ who was talking in between songs. And I never wanted to I never wanted the show to be, look at the disabled guy doing a podcast. I wanted the show to speak for itself. However, once I started talking about it, it created a conversation between me and the guest that they might not otherwise have. And it created the opportunity for you to sit here and ask me questions. It's a nice back and forth. When you're interviewed, it's all about the host. It's all about you sometimes. But if you have a question, share it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm so glad that I started talking about my disability on this podcast and making it sort of a part of the show without becoming part of the show.
Well, you know, I think you were maybe alluding to asking me if talking about the stuff that I struggled with was hard for a long time. I don't know if that's what you were bringing up.
Like, I just wanted to know, like, what do you think about me? What do you think of my approach as far as hiding that part of me? Like, do you think, I know you're not on the clock, but this is kind of a therapy session. but what is your thoughts on that? Because I've always wanted to know what is your opinion on that?
Well, I think it's wonderful. I think that, you know, look, when we deny parts of ourselves and pretend like they're not there, they're just gonna fester and come up in other ways, right? And I went for a long time in my life thinking, I didn't want to talk about my past. I didn't want to talk about my pain. Both because it was too painful for me to bring it up, and because I didn't want to bore people with it, or I didn't want people to feel sorry for me for what I'd lost or what I had failed at or whatever. And then it's been so empowering to talk about some, you know, to take things that I've been trying to hide and bring them to the light, and then to realize the power in that, to realize that what you have gained is something that can help people. And so to deny that would be a shame, right? I mean, to bring it into the room and to create an opportunity to have a dialogue as you have, I think is a powerful force for good, because people need to hear these conversations. I mean, whether you're somebody listening to this that has a diagnosis like yourself or otherwise, or somebody who has just struggled in terms of dealing with loss of identity as I have, or other challenges in life, you know, when you hear people talking about it, both in terms of having overcome it in some ways, or still struggling with it in some ways, just being vulnerable. I think that that's the key element, to be able to be willing to be vulnerable. It's therapeutic for you and I, but it's also really helpful for people to realize that you don't have to have it all figured out. Like, you can be in the middle of it, in the middle of a process, and be working towards contentment and fulfillment in your life and still be struggling, and that's okay.
And there are times when I do feel creative burnout. Like, I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. And that's because I have the issue of saying yes to everything.
Yeah.
And then when it becomes too much, I freak out. Mm-hmm. I turn into a person that I don't want to be. And then there's always a moment where I listen to a podcast that I've done or something, where I get a cool interview and it's like, oh yeah, this is why I do what I do. So I'm always brought back mm-hmm. to where I need to be.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I think that it's my nature as well to say yes to too much. In terms of the band and our career, that was not something I really even had much of a choice about, because once we got to the point where we had, an album and songs on the charts, we were getting instructions from everyone like, you don't know if you're going to have another hit, so say yes to everything on your first big album, because it'll pay dividends in the future in your career. If you say no to things, then you burn those bridges and they'll never ask again. And so for really 4 years of our life, 2002, 3, 4, 5, like, we basically just, whatever was offered us, we did it, and it was never ending. And it took a toll on me. It really, you know, I ended up burnt out before I even had started having, you know, the physical symptoms and then the psychological symptoms of breakdown. I was just exhausted and burnt out. And that's an extreme example. You know, I mean, obviously not everyone can relate to that level of the demands on your time and energy, that where you're traveling constantly and performing every day. And
just even the sense of like doing too much. Yeah. So everybody can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
What is an event or appearance that Maroon 5 was offered that fell through that you wish you guys did?
Fell through. Well, there were things that I obviously didn't get to participate in that the band did, and that were really devastating for me, because there were moments when we were going to get to do something that we, you know, had dreamt about. I was fortunate enough to be able to perform on Saturday Night Live, which was a huge thing we had dreamt about for a long time. And it went well, and that was a great moment. But then a year later, you know, when I was going through all the struggles I was going through, the band was asked to perform on the Grammys and the opening medley. And I was hoping that I could come back for that. And unfortunately, I just wasn't able to play well enough to do that. So I ended up, you know, singing my harmonies from the soundboard and watching from afar. Obviously, I'm grateful that we won a Grammy. I'm grateful that we were there and that I was a part of it. But it was obviously heartbreaking to not be able to be on stage with the band that I'd spent a decade getting to that point with, and being able to do that. I can't remember the band thing, anything falling through for the whole band, because, you know, we were basically doing everything.
Because I'm thinking, did you guys ever, I know it sounds crazy, but one of the rites of passage, if you're a musician, did you guys ever do Sesame Street? Did the band ever do that?
No, not that I was a part of. I don't remember if Adam might have gone on there.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
I'm a Muppet nerd too.
That was actually Adam does a great impression of Kermit the Frog singing what's his song?
Being Green.
I think, is it the Rainbow Connection? Is
that yeah,
the
yeah.
One? Yeah. He does a good impression of that. So I would love to see a duet, you know.
So what can people expect from your book, and where can people grab it?
So Harder to Breathe, the book, which obviously was the name came from the song, but it has multiple meanings to me. You can expect a roller coaster memoir. It's got all of the fun and inspiration of a band starting out as teenagers and dreaming to be rock stars, and all of the, you know, the ins and outs of that journey, the personalities, the relationships, but then, you know, the subtext being my individual experience, which led to this heartbreak and devastation. So it goes from some really high highs to some really low lows, but ultimately it's a hopeful book. It's I wrote it to inspire people that might relate to some of my struggles and could potentially see themselves in my recovery. And so there's some lessons learned in the last third of the book, looking back on my journey. And I think you can take some hope, but also some practical tools for some of the things that I have been able to overcome. You can find it anywhere. It's on Amazon right now. You can order it. I have a website, ryandusick.com, which has updates on everything that I'm doing. You can reach out to me there. And then there's my Instagram page at Ryan Michael Dusick, which I post a lot of fun stuff on to keep up with me. But right now I'm a therapist, I'm a coach, I'm an author, and I'm doing a lot of speaking engagements as well. So like three or four different careers I've kind of begun all at once.
So to wrap this up, and when I have these conversations, I don't have the goal in my head, I'm going to inspire this person today. I'm going to make an impact.
Right.
But is there anything, like, what have you learned from our time together today? I'm curious.
Well, you know, this has been unique, to say the least. You're right. A lot of these quote unquote interviews, it ends up being, you know, one person asking me questions and facilitating me basically saying the same things I've said 100 times now. And I really did appreciate that your willingness to be vulnerable and to flip the script a little bit. I think I've learned, because I've had my own, like, I'm sort of just brainstorming ways in which I can use my platform to reach people in unique ways. And up until to this point, it's really just been an effort to be vulnerable, to tell my story in a way that I do have the intent of trying to, not necessarily like give someone answers, but give them the hope that there are answers, or that it's okay that they don't have the answers yet. But seeing that, you know, you can flip the script in that way to have a conversation with somebody who may have some similarities with you, but may also have some very distinct differences in terms of the things that have been challenging. That gives me a lot to think about in terms of the context and the ways in which we have these dialogues. And it just opens up a lot in my mind. I think I'm going to be brainstorming on for the next week about the possibilities with that.
I would love to keep in touch with you. And thank you so much for this.
Thank you. I appreciate this. This has been really interesting, really great. I really I appreciate what you do.